28, and at 10:28, we'll be done. And as I indicated, we do want to have a chance to just dialogue with Douglas first, and then maybe we'll bring in the other two. We'll see how the flow goes here. But, all right, anyone want to start off? Questions? Comments?
I'll dive into this over here.
Okay.
I think that probably I was most moved and had been most impacted by your book, Thinking the Faith. And, it seems to me that you do something in there which a lot of North American theologians have not done, is that you've taken the critique of the liberation theologian seriously and saying that, yes, we do have to do theology contextually. And then you've done something else with that, and that is to take and make the task of doing theology the task of all people who confess their faith. And I guess I'd like to have you kind of comment, partly to say is that an accurate perception of a significant part of that book, and where does that lead you as you are working on book two, I would assume, at this point?
Excuse me, the first one was again?
Taking the context seriously, and that we do need to do theology
of the liberation.
In our context.
Yeah.
And then that also takes much more seriously the role of every person who confesses the faith as a person to do theology in their own particular, peculiar context.
Yes, certainly that's an accurate perception of what I wanted to do. In that, and what I want to do generally. I have been, moved, as most people who read theology have. Can you hear me all right? My voice is rather low, and I realize it doesn't carry very well in a room like this. Did you hear the question, first of all, those of you who are round and about?
Yeah.
I have been moved, as most people who read theology are, I think, by liberation theology, especially as it comes out of third world contexts, whether that means Latin America or Korea or wherever it might be. But I've also been disturbed in some way by the manner in which we in North America are such consumers theologically. We have a whole history of consuming the theology of Europe in sloganized form, and it disturbed me that we also tried to do this, or still try, I think some of us, with liberation theology. You know, with a slight twist of the theological wrist, we say, oh, this is a good theology, let's use this, let's apply it to the North American situation. And there are ways in which it can be applied. I mean, oppressors also need to be liberated and that sort of thing. But I think that liberation, I put it this way sometimes, that liberation theology is a theology for those who fell amongst thieves. And we are the thieves. How do you develop a theology for thieves? And especially thieves who don't really look like thieves and really are very nice people. But the methodology of liberation theology is the right methodology for us too. It's the content we can't simply import the content. The method we should use, I think. Then the second comment about everybody having to do theology, that's bound up with my understanding of what's going on in the church today. I think we are at the end of the Constantinian era, and that we are entering a new phase of diaspora, also here in North America and in other parts of the formerly Christian world. And I think we have already discovered that people are not prepared to stay within the church, because of extraneous things, you know, such as it being good for business, or even, you know, the family that prays together stays together and all that, because they don't often. So if you're going to remain there, you have to have a reason to be in it. And I think this will increase. Of course, I realize that churches serve many functions in our society, but I think wherever the church is serious about its relation to its context, we are going to have to realize more and more that theology will have to become a communal enterprise of the whole community. I don't think that means that there will no longer be room for professional theologians like me, or ministers like most of you. My colleague Peter used the expression theologian in residence tonight. I think this is a very important concept. Not everybody gets the chance to study the tradition, you know, in a disciplined manner and over a fairly long period of time. And yet this kind of exposure is very important if the church is to continue to be in touch with its tradition. So I think there always will be a place for professional, in quotes, professional theology. But I think that increasingly every Christian will have to be able to give a reason for the hope that is in him or her. So yes, I agree with your reading of what I'm trying to do. Definitely.
I appreciate your expansion on that.
Wally?
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if you touched on part of my question of just looking into your crystal ball of what the church will hold. I'm wondering if you could talk about society and what you see in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years as you look into a crystal ball.
I mean, society in relation to religious questions, or just generally?
Well, some of what I was hearing you is you ticked off your 4 points this afternoon or this morning. Is it more of the same, or are we going to run into a brick wall?
I think I would like to say in relation to that question something that perhaps I should have said earlier. I feel as a Canadian today a particular sense of crisis, because I live in a country that really might well break up. That puts me into almost a state of mourning if I think about it, because I have had high hopes for my country. I think it's a wonderful country, both in terms of the space that it occupies, in terms of the kinds of opportunities that it offers, and in terms of its history. We share a great deal with your country in many ways. I mean, we are part of the same folk, but we also have pursued an alternative route. And it seems to me that if our country breaks up, if first Quebec and then other regions, we have a strong regional identity now in Canada, which militates against a unified witness of the country. And it seems to me that if this goes on, it will lead to a balkanized situation. And the alternative that we could stand for in the international community, and the kind of witness that we could make, and at the best of moments have made, for example in the Suez crisis did make, we will not be able to make any longer. So I feel a sense of crisis that coming out of my particular identity as a Canadian today, and of urgency, because in fact there's now a time limit on this. Because in September of 1992, that is about 1 year from now, a referendum will be held in the province of Quebec, where I live, and it will be decided whether Quebec will go it alone or not. by the people. And the present mood in Quebec of the majority of people is that they want to separate. So there's a kind of urgency in the whole thing. I suppose I bring this feeling of crisis into my analysis generally, but I think that the crisis in which we are all involved in the Western world is not something that's very new. I mean, it's been going on for a very long time already. It goes back at least to the time of Teddy Roosevelt in your country. I have read recently Gore Vidal's novel Empire, which is, I think, a very clever study of recent history of the United States of America. So I think this crisis is a very long one, and I certainly don't think we've come to the end of it. I don't like to predict the future, but I think that we have, as Christians at any rate, to try to find the courage to look into the crises that we experience in history, not to fear them, not to fear the crises, because a crisis is not just a negative thing. A crisis is a possibility of metanoia. It offers opportunities as well as things that frighten and cause despair. And I think that, you know, we ought to realize that not everybody can bear the analysis and exposure that is needed to crises if they're going to become ways into the future and not brick walls, as you say. I feel very often that my children, should not have to bear this crisis in the same way as I should bear it. I have certain strengths as a person who has experienced a certain amount of life, as a Christian who has a system of meaning to fall back on. These strengths give me the opportunity to enter the crisis and to try to understand it and to try to alter the course that it might take, to try to influence the course that it might take. So, I mean, whether we are going to be led farther and farther into impossible situations, or whether there will be, you know, at the Red Sea, at the edge of the Red Sea, an opening, will depend a good deal on what we, who have the strength to enter the crisis consciously, what we do about this. And one of the things we have to do is to be truthful about it, not shut our eyes to it and pretend that everything is fine. Okay? Yes.
It's one thing to read and clarify for ourselves as professionals the crisis, and it's another thing to clarify for people we live with the crisis and have them deal with that, especially in a society that denies so much.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could recommend, what I try to do is have available for people different directions they can go in order to clarify and struggle with the ideas, and so I have a tendency to focus on different writers, and I'm wondering, we had talked a little on the boat about authors, I'm wondering if you could recommend, which authors do you recommend today to deal with life issues, or what are your favorites that you recommend for us to enter the struggle and try to clarify for themselves?
Well, there are, you know, and we talked about this too. You and I and some other people in this room have entered that particular age where names fly out of your head. And, you know, my colleague Gregory Baum will begin a sentence in the following way. My dear friend Oh, I forgot his name. And when you ask me a question about specific authors, and my name, my head immediately draws a blank. But I thought immediately of one author. My countryman George Grant should be read by more Americans. Unfortunately, George Grant is not known in this country very well, although Bella and other people quote him as a kind of philosophic authority. I think George Grant's works are much, much better as a guide into the, as he would call it, the terra incognita, the unknown land of the present and the future. They're a better guide than people like Christopher Lash, whom I also like, and these books that sort of pop up as bestsellers all the time. They're very good, but I think Grant has a long-range view. I mean, he is founded in the classics. He knows Plato very well. You know, he knows the classical tradition of Athens as well as Jerusalem. He was an Anglican. He was an Anglican layman, but a very, very cultured and educated man who thought about our society in profound ways. And I would really recommend that you try to get hold of books like Technology and Empire, a series of essays published by House of Anansi, A-N-A-N-S-I, in Toronto. Or I think one of his is published by an American publisher called English Speaking Justice. One of the best of his books was called Philosophy in the Mass Age. These were CBC lectures. Or another one, Time as History, which is an analysis of the thought of Nietzsche, whom I mentioned this morning. I mean, George Grant has thought our new world society in a way that I don't know of anyone else who's thought so profoundly as he. Another author I would recommend is Ernest Becker, whom I mentioned in Thinking the Faith. I don't really know all of Becker's works, but I do know his book, The Denial of Death, very well. I have marked, learned, and inwardly digested that book. I think that's one of the most perceptive books about what not just individuals, but human cultures do in the face of death, in the face of the death of systems of meaning, and so on. Of course, you have to read. I mean, if you want to encounter the great philosophic and theological questions of the age, you have to read novelists and playwrights, and probably not, on the whole, philosophers. Sociologists, yes, I suppose, but I always feel that the novelists and playwrights are less dangerous than the sociologists or the psychology, the other social scientists, because they don't have such obvious axes to grind. I mean, they rather more reflect the society, and at the same time, in reflecting the darkness of the society, they bring a certain light to it, because, as I will say tomorrow, darkness realized is already light. That's Joseph Sittler. But I mean, people like Margaret Atwood and Alice Walker and Robertson Davies and Alice Munro. I don't know if Alice Munro is known here, but Alice Munro is one of the most, I mean, she writes the most beautiful books, much, much better than, much more beautiful than Margaret Atwood. Also, there's a whole French-Canadian literature which is translated into English, and that would be interesting for you who read novels to look at French-Canadian analyses of life in the New World, because it differs significantly from English-speaking analyses, whether they come out of the United States or Canada. I don't know how many of you saw Jésus de Montréal, Jesus of Montreal, the film Jesus of Montreal. I think that could only have happened out of formerly Catholic Quebec, which is today such a secular society, but the imagery is still very much there. Well, films and novels and so on. Yeah, we could go on and on anyway about this.
In your book, Thinking the Faith, you there are a couple things that I'd like to try and invite you to tie together. One is an assertion that Lutherans, because of a peculiar quirk in our piety and history, have maintained some access to theology of the cross, perhaps more so than others. Also, a contention that theology often gets done by accident in committees through representative groups, and you suggest that that's not particularly helpful. You have some suggestions for the life of the church as to ways in which we can structure thoughtful reflection without programmatic responsibility, or if that sounds like even a good idea.
That last, you need to spell that last bit out a bit for me.
We want committees in the life of the church, for example, to produce things.
Yeah.
To run a program or to do a show or promote a dance or whatever. Is there, in your perception, a place in the church for a group that is invited particularly to sit and reflect in the context of a geographic area, for example, about the faith in that place, without programmatic kinds of responsibility?
Oh, that's very interesting. That's very interesting in the light of a recent experience I had, in fact, just 2 weeks ago. Because of the crisis in our country, I was called to be one of 17 persons from various positions, so-called positions of leadership in the country, to come together in a retreat center for something like 3.5 days without any agenda, but simply to sit and talk to each other. And these included a novelist, Joy Kogawa, the Japanese-Canadian novelist who wrote a novel called Obasan, a wonderful novel. Indian chief, who was one of the people being considered for the presidency of all the Indian, the native peoples in Canada. Archbishop Ted Scott of the Anglican Church, two moderators of the United Church, political leaders, labor leaders, and people like this. And we simply sat and talked, the 17 of us, with nice little periods of leisure in between so that it wasn't, you know, burdensome. And it was marvelous. We didn't have to produce anything. We just talked to each other. And it was really very productive. I'm sure it will change all of us in significant ways. But I've had very bad experiences with cooperative endeavors at theology. And the worst of all was in connection with the Justice, Peace, and Integrity of Creation program of the World Council of Churches. I was the final redactor for the document that went to Seoul, the document that everybody was given to take to Seoul to the World Convocation. My job was to take the existing document and make it into something like a consistent in style and consistent in content even, and it was impossible. And it was like saying, make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, you know, because it was a conglomeration of statements of every which style and every which sort of concern, going from highfalutin theological statements to little stories, my name is so-and-so and I come from so-and-so in Fiji and so on. And I thought it was an impossible task. So at least we have to be aware of the dangers of this kind of committee theology. I mean, perhaps it's an old-fashioned thing, but I feel that theology has to be done through the sieve of a particular experience. But I mean, when I sit at my computer all alone in my little old basement study and do things, I don't feel alone. And one of the reasons I keep coming out to events of this sort is to realize that I am not alone, and to connect what I'm doing with specific faces and specific questions and concerns. I don't think that individual work has to be individualistic, if you know what I mean. Now, but the first thing you mentioned was also interesting to me, and I've forgotten what it was.
Well, about the Lutheran tradition of the cross,
right,
in the light of your analysis of the culture.
I'm going to say more about this tomorrow. I don't think that I'm being romantic. I mean, it's easy to be romantic when you look into another denomination from outside of it, you know. I know some people, like my colleague Gregory Baum, who's a Roman Catholic, looks into my church, the United Church of Canada, and thinks it's wonderful. But living in it, I don't feel that way. Now, I mean, maybe I see things in the Lutheran Church that you don't see, and maybe I'm being romantic, but I do know that if I say the term, if I offer the expression theology of the cross, in most of the denominations of this continent, and I have to do with most of them in one way or another, that most of the people who hear that phrase will think that I'm talking about the doctrine of the atonement, at the most. They don't connect it with a whole sort of spirit and method of doing theology. What Jürgen Moltmann said, the theology of the cross is not about a specific aspect of theology, it is the key signature of theology. And, I mean, you have some... You see, it's not accidental either. I mean, there's no special mystique to it. It's not thanks to you that this is the case. But, in fact, that guy, Martin Luther, who invented the phrase, he didn't invent the theology, but he invented the term, was in so many ways a medieval man. I mean, he was a pre-modern man. He was very unlike Calvin and Zwingli, in my opinion, and theologically my roots are with Calvin and Zwingli, not with Martin Luther, I mean, denominationally. But I know, because I teach the history of Christian thought, how different is the ethos of those two guys whose background was the new humanism, and Luther, who was coming out of this backwards northern German, northeastern Saxonian peasantry with its kind of sense of, you know, burning bushes and things and lightning storms and the messages that were contained and everything, this kind of mystical sense. And so this is, in a way, what I'm saying is the Lutheran tradition, whether you make good at that tradition, of course, is your own doing, but the tradition is there for you to reach back behind modernity. You have a perspective behind and before modernity on the basis of which to understand modernity. Because one of the points of George Grant is we can't really understand ourselves as modern people unless we have some perspective outside of modernity on the basis of which to understand, to interpret modernity. For him, that means, in a special way, the Platonic tradition. And he can draw on Anglican interpretation of the Platonic tradition. But for you, that could mean... And by the way, for French, Canadian, Roman Catholics, that means the old Thomistic tradition. But for you, it means this tradition that you get at through the thought of Luther and those who picked up Luther, taking you back into the German mystics, Meister Eckhart and all those people, and carrying you into another plane of interpretation. And for me, this is a very unique thing about the Lutheran tradition, especially when you think about the influence of Calvinism, not so much Calvin, but Calvinism in this country. in this country particularly. Yes?
You talked about the difficulty of committee theology. I'd like to raise an example of committee theology and let you comment on it, namely the statement of the Canadian bishops, in this case Roman Catholic bishops, on the economy. What you think of their process as a committee in terms of developing that theology, and what's your evaluation of the substance of the statement as a prophetic statement of ecumenical value?
I'm very impressed by what the bishops have said on that subject. I don't know whether I would call it, that's not comparable to the kind of committee theology that we were doing in the World Council, because it was so much wider. I mean, the bishops have a certain unanimity, or a certain at least basic educational background and responsibility, and they have many things in common.
And the similarity is that in both cases, the bishops not only consulted themselves, but all kinds of lay people,
right,
experts. That was the intent of the World Council, and that's what occurred in some countries, like East Germany.
Right.
And so it's not an impossible process, and I just wanted you to comment on where it appeared to succeed.
No, I think this kind of process is very good. It has worked in other situations too. I was just trying to think of an example. The Methodist bishops called together some of us. I think about 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I was asked to go down to Atlanta, and many other people were invited to do the same thing. And we were to show up before this committee of something like 7 bishops, who were representative committee of the bishops of the Methodist Church in the USA, to say to them what we thought was happening with the church, what's going on in the church today. And so we each went there and made our little testimony, and then they came out with a report. I think that's a very responsible use of expertise, so-called expertise, not just theologians, but they were asking other people who had sociological and other kinds of, and biblical and so on, expertise. One of the things that's a danger in the present sort of, I don't know, I think it's a kind of pseudo-democratic mood that has swept across organizations like the World Council and the World Alliance of Reformed Churches and so on. One of the dangers is that people have lost the knack of using expertise. At the great convocation in Seoul, where all of this program of justice, peace, and the integrity of creation was to come together, there were about, I think, 60 or 70 of us who were designated theological advisors, counselors, advisors or something. We were in a group there. And these were people who were representative not only of theological points of view. Most of us were not theologians. Most of us were scientists, demographers, ecologists, economists, labor people, and so on and so on. And increasingly, as I watched that during that whole week, that little section disappeared. I mean, there would be 10 there instead of 70 one day. And people would be floating in, because nobody asked us ever our opinions. We just weren't consulted. I mean, there are a lot of people who can help us today in the church to figure out some of the problems that we are facing, and I think we have to learn how to call on these people.
Let's try one more, and then we'll see if we can do a little other dialogue. Yes, you had a question.
You spend a lot of time in your book talking about continuity and discontinuous, and the tension in Christianity between continuous and discontinuous.
With the culture?
Right.
Yeah.
And within the church.
Yeah.
And then you want to talk about the scandal under the cross, and that we get into a problem when we have false scandals.
Oh, yes.
False scandals.
Yes.
Okay, and you mentioned a false scandal is when some aspect of Christianity is identified as as the core of faith and elevate it to dogma.
Oh, yeah.
And I was, you mentioned one such as the virgin birth.
Yes.
And it seemed to me previously in the book that you had talked about that as one that is vital to the continuous and discontinuous tension.
Ah, yeah.
And where do you put those together?
Oh, you are a sophist in the making, eh? Caught. I'm caught. Well, no, I think I'll try to wiggle out of it. I think the virgin birth, to me, the teaching of the virgin birth is not a meaningless dogma. You know, I think it has meaning. And like most symbols, its meaning lies at many different levels. But one of the levels is this business of continuity and discontinuity. The male factor is set aside, you know, the discontinuity. Even though the continuity factor, the genealogy of Jesus is then traced through the male, Joseph, strangely. Continuity, I mean, this is one little level of meaning that's there. There are many levels of meaning in this symbol. But when I said that thing about being held up as a false scandal, I mean, when you say, let me be concrete. When I was a student at Union Seminary, as with most of you, it was the habit that you were to do field work in the churches round and about, and I did my field work for 2 years in a church called Brick Church in East Orange, New Jersey, Presbyterian. And when I went for the interview, I mean, I was one of several who were interviewed for this job because it was thought to be a kind of plum. You know, for students. The minister, who was one of those 90-day wonders from Edinburgh, you know, in the days when they turned out doctorates for writing doctoral theses on hymns and things like that. And he was a self-styled conservative character whose key question in the whole thing was, do you believe in the virgin birth? You know? And all the others said no, and I said yes. But meaning, I didn't go on to explain what I meant. and I got the job. I mean, this becomes a kind of key question. Do you believe in the divinity of Jesus? Do you believe in the resurrection of the flesh and all this? These become key questions which simply turn people off. The ones who can't answer yes don't get the job. And I think this is really false, because that's not the core of the gospel, is it? That's holding up some kind of thing around the edges and making it the center. Now, there are occasions when that question can be central, but they're not the usual occasions, I think.
But it wouldn't be appropriate to mythologize that. Some people want to make it a myth, mythologize it. That's totally appropriate. And that would be continuing.
I guess I stumble someplace between myth and symbol on that one.
I'm going to invite Elizabeth and Pete in, please. The empty chairs, okay?
I'm going to ask you
to be quiet. Oh my God. Now you guys have to take over with that. Everything I know.
No, I don't think so. I'm going to start it out this way. We've been listening to them now, Douglas. These two here, Pete and Elizabeth, raise a critical question to one of them at a time. Okay.
No.
One of them. Where would you like to debate? Huh? Okay.
Could we be clear that this goes only till 10:30?
10:28.
Right.
Yeah, it has to be for you, because really now it's already 10 after 1 for me, and I'm getting rather crazy. as you could probably tell. Well, I mean, yeah, this is a little difficult, but because one needs on these questions a lot of discussion. But Elizabeth, I would like to ask you, to put the question very, very simply, is the problem patriarchy or is it archy? I mean, archy means being first. And certainly in terms of our history, the pater has been first. There's no question about that. But, shouldn't we be a little more afraid of power?
Who's we?
All of us. I mean, women too. Does power ever become the human being?
Yes, but that hasn't been women's dilemma by and large.
Yeah.
So I don't worry a lot about abstract power systems without material content. I worry about those that I encounter, and while having a system that entails somebody being first might in principle be a bad idea, I deal with the material content that's actually there, and that's patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And it could be that if we ever got rid of it, some other equally obnoxious system would come in, and then we'd fight that one too.
Okay.
And then a third one, and then we might conclude that there is a principle here that's really at issue. And it's a certain kind of hierarchy of power. But I can't think about it that abstractly anymore. I have a question I'd like to pose.
Yeah.
How did you make the decision to treat so little of slavery in your articulation of the development of the dream stage for America? And a subsidiary part of that is, how did Mexico disappear so completely?
Yeah. Well, in terms of the first part of the question, I mean, that is a weakness in my thinking. I recognize that, and it reflects my Canadianism. I mean, there are ways in which what I've written in this book betray the fact that I'm not an American, and some of these ways I think are good, and others. Because in a way, you know, standing on the edge of empire and looking into the empire, as you must if you try to write about North America, you get a little perspective. On things that are not always seen if you're in the middle of it. I mean, you can, I think, but I certainly think it's a deficiency in what I've written that I haven't got enough about black slavery. I hope to correct that in the second volume by having more consciousness of black theology than I have had in that book.
I think it makes it appear that the threat and the decline and the despair is worse than it might be for some people who have seen the rot in the dream for a much longer period of time.
Yes.
Already.
Yeah, right. You're quite right. What was the second part of that?
Mexico.
Oh, Mexico. Yeah, that's a difficult one because in a way, I mean, sometimes in the book I say, rather honestly, I think, the two northern countries of this continent, you know. Because in a way, I mean, Mexico is part of North America, but in another way it's not part of North America in terms of its cultural history, it seems to me. I can identify with Mexico in some ways as a Canadian, interestingly, and I haven't said that in my books, but I was telling somebody tonight about One of the presidents of Mexico who was who was kicked out and sent away. I don't know who he was. And as he was going away in the ship, he said, "Poor Mexico, so far from God and so close to the United States." And I mean, I can identify somewhat with that, you know. But at the same time, I don't identify, because we have much more in common with you than Mexico has.
Except that I think one of the major challenges for the United States is finally coming to terms with the equally long history of the United States that was determined from the Southwest, not from New England.
Yeah.
So that we have an immense affinity with Mexico that now is becoming, for many whites, a real... A little more strongly. Yeah.
Pete, do you want to get in with the question?
I'm having fun.
Either one of you.
She's figuring out whether we're fused or separated.
Yeah, I'd like to answer those for the question. You say a very provocative and a word that pokes, and it's important. And you talk about change in the church. If that time came where the white male system that prevails in the church would relinquish some of its power and also its ways of thinking, its own consciousness, what would be different? How would you see the church, either in terms of organizing itself, determining who it would be, etc.? What would be the dream?
I will answer that retrospectively, and Jim Milton will back me up, I suspect, in this memory. We were both members of CNLC, the Commission for the So-Called New Lutheran Church. And the first meeting we arrived, 70 people to concoct this thing. And we walked into the meeting room, and it was set up like pews that are immovable, all facing forward. And the meeting started with Robert's Rules of Order, no introduction of the people to each other. And that night, after the initial session, there was a rebellion. And we proposed that we think of alternative ways of structuring ourselves, knowing full well that how we did it in CNLC would eventually get expressed in what we came up with 4 years later. So we refused to go on until there were small group meetings so we could find out something of our expectations about the process and who these people were. And we didn't manage to get the seating changed too much, but the tables were angled at least so you could see half of the people. And this was for 4 years a constant battle. I think what we walked into was a very good example of basically masculinist expectations of process, the X stuff that you described this evening. And if women, and I mean women who identify as women, not male-identified women, if women had set that process up, it would have been utterly different. I don't think it would have been the immune system model of tonight. It would have been closer to the feminist model, I suspect. But what we would have done is accomplished in shorter time what the men thought they were going to accomplish efficiently. That is, we would have created a structure which arose out of the actual lives of people in the church. In the name of efficiency, we created something to get done according to a timetable. And now we're discovering a great disjunction between that structure and the lives of people in the church.
Yeah.
So in the name of efficiency, what have we got? The feminist approach, I think, is much more efficient if you take a little longer view. So that's one example of what I think is a pattern. I really think it's apt to say that men think in terms of functional, instrumental tasks, and women think in terms of relationships. That's a hyperbolic generalization of a gross sort, but there's enough truth in it to make it worth thinking about. Another thing is that we would never have a theology which has a major metaphor that of child sacrifice by the parent.
By the parent.
That the father sends the son to die and says, "This is good. This is how all good happens."
What would you have?
Well, I think it would depend in part on the needs at issue. And I know that there are women who have bought into the notion that you send your sons off to war for the greater good of something or other. So I'm not saying that there would be no women who would ever, that no woman would ever cooperate in such a system. But I think what women try to do is bind up wounds themselves, not send surrogates.
Right. Yeah.
And then create out of that, the poem of the woman who makes the rag rugs, I think is what women would do. You take whatever remnants there are from the uses of the community, and you make something that is functional and beautiful and the locus of community action.
So instead of sending the son, the father would go himself, so to speak. The crucified God.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, I think Trinitarian thought has tried to approach that, but...
But it's been so afraid of Patripassianism, of the fact that God might suffer, you know, and wanting to keep God omnipotent.
Nice. Yeah.
Mm. Was Dr. Sankey asking you, though, how it would look like in our churches? Were you asking how it would look like in our churches if we followed the H model, or the how power could be shared?
Not only in power, but also how consciousness would be shaped, I think. There are different ways of knowing. And how do you want to talk about that?
Well, I think I already have. When I hear the word church, I tend to speak out of my own experience, and it's much more church-wide structures than local congregations.
Right.
You learned a lot about me in my answer there.
And me too.
I think that I think we'd have much more, and this is going to sound trite because it's said so often, but I think we would have much more storytelling. Telling, you know, I would love to hear you all in a conference like this, and I tried to urge it out a couple of times sneakily. I'd love to hear you talk about how you understand God. One of the reasons I hardly ever have anything to do with church anymore, to be perfectly honest about it, is that I find conversations about God much more exciting elsewhere. And especially clergy are very uptight about talking not about what the church teaches officially about God, but what you know about God. And especially admitting the doubts. Admitting the doubts.
Yeah.
When you got more holes.
Well, there are
hands. I don't know. Seminary. I mean, when you go to seminary, you have doubts. You're scared to say them because you're afraid they won't let you through the system. They'll call you a heretic. So you shut them down, and then you get the parish and the parishioners expect you to know it all. So you shut them down. You can't share your doubts.
But it's very bad theology, then.
It's awful. But that's the system, or at least that's how we perceive the system. And people are too scared.
That's how we participate in the system.
Yeah.
You know, I'm responsible for who I trust and for how I act out that trust. You know, the system isn't responsible for whether I'm afraid or not.
Here, here.
I'm responsible for whether I'm afraid or not, and I'm responsible for how I live that fear out. So, you know, I don't go for this business that the system is the thing that's at fault for causing me to be the way I am. There's not a cause and effect relationship there.
I'm afraid, and I act on that fear one way or another. I either choose to risk and possibly suffer darkness, the night, death, all those kinds of negative images, or the other possibility of resurrection, you know?
My experience at seminary as a woman was very different than that, because I felt I was encouraged to doubt, and it was a safe place to do that. And I was amazed, actually, and I was very encouraged to doubt, question and search and doubt, and I sense that in the parish that would scare people. It was very threatening.
But that's an interesting thing, because I would wonder if it would really scare people. It might scare some people, but I wonder, you know, see, it always seemed to me that in parish situations we have this kind of odd Kafkaesque thing going on. Mm-hmm. That is, that the congregation thinks that it should think certain things about the minister, and the minister thinks that he or she should think certain things about things about the parish, you know. And so there's all this kind of shoulding going on. You know, and if we could just get out of these stereotypes of one another. In fact, I discovered in my very short parish experience that there are all kinds of people on the periphery of the congregation, as well as many within it, and even very close to the center of it, who were glad to find out that I wasn't a professional believer. That I could understand if somebody said, I believe, but help my unbelief. And even get this into my, get my unbelief and my the difficulty of believing into my prayers. I mean, the Psalms of Israel are not your ideal sort of should be, you know. I mean, there's all kinds of agonizing about, you know, are you asleep or what happened to you?
We created a doubting group for our church, for younger folks. The old people came.
Isn't Gary that Peter interesting?
Talks about the poor, depressed pastors who have to get up Sunday after Sunday preaching things that nobody believes but wish they did.
Yeah. Or think they should.
I know, or think they should.
Yeah.
What about, if I may ask a personal question, the three of you, I think Elizabeth, you actually answered it. Are you yourselves active members of any community of faith?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I am too, but my wife goes more often than I do. And the reason is I'm often not around to do it. But I must say, I share with Elizabeth that, you know, that's a difficult thing. I think there's a lot of unreality in the churches. I mean, I go to a church that, you know, was once the Protestant Church of Montreal, Erskine and American Church, if anybody knows it. I mean, it thinks that everybody should know it, but now it's a has-been. I mean, what it's mostly famous for now is its Tiffany windows, which the museum next door always wants to get hold of. And I feel nothing real is going on in that church, and therefore I don't enjoy being there. I don't find it in any way edifying. Sometimes the music is real.
We're in this particular edification.
Right here. I have to say, in these kinds of, I realize that I have a really, really mixed up life because I haven't got my priorities straightened out, and therefore I try to do all of these things and I get all mixed up, writing and directing doctoral students and giving lectures and coming around. But one of the reasons I should say no more often to things like this, if I want to be sane and live long, But one of the reasons I realize that I come to things like this is I meet people here who give me some kind of sense of the reality of the gospel. I'm not trying to flatter you. I mean, I felt very often in these days, you would maybe not sense it, but I felt in personal conversation very moved. And I don't get this very often in the congregation that I attend.
Tonight, Peter, you talked about every system needs a hierarchy, and the system piece of me said, yeah, I'm going to hang in there, and the feminist part of me became quite uncomfortable. And I was wondering if your colleagues could comment on the, how that fits for their own sense of church.
60 seconds.
No, I'm we didn't hear the last part.
I was wondering if your colleague could comment on how that sense of a system needing or being a hierarchy, a leader, how that fits for your own sense of church today.
Did she say comment?
Yeah, if your colleague, that is, if we two would come in. I'd rather. We're all fused up there. 30 seconds.
I am deaf in my left ear, so I don't hear well in a room like this, so I'm sorry I didn't hear it. But you said colleagues?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, my quick comment would be that I can accept the hierarchy. Understanding if it's not ontological, but if it is vocationally orientated. That is, it's not something that I am, but something that I do, that I'm called to do. But I think it's a dangerous thing if you think of it in terms of worth. I mean, we have this hierarchic conception of creation with us at the top and the stones or whatever at the bottom. And I would rather change it to a vocational understanding. We human beings have got a certain vocation within the creation. That doesn't mean we have a worth other than our vocation. That's how I would put it.
Let's be hard-nosed about our promise to let them off. Thank you very much.
You got that.